You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 22nd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, ACLU Deputy Director for Transgender Justice Chase Strangio. On the over 37 bills introduced in just the past weeks that are anti-trans. Meanwhile, the Biden administration considers airlifting migrants to Canada, or I should say to the Canadian border, for processing, as they are still struggling with the mess Donald Trump left them. New claim of harassment against Cuomo, this time from a current aide. AstraZeneca claims 79% efficacy in preventing symptomatic COVID, 100% in preventing serious illness or death. It's prepping to seek emergency authorization in this country. Meanwhile, drug companies hoard their technology, starving poor nations of vaccine in order to reap billions in huge profits. Maybe that's redundant. IRS researchers to release a report claiming extensive tax dodging by the top 1%, twice what had been previously estimated. AOC and Elizabeth Warren introduce a bill to put $500 billion into electric public transit. The DOJ anticipates sedition charges based on evidence collected from the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Meanwhile, the outer fence is down, finally, from the Capitol in Washington, D.C. In New York City's mayoral race, Andrew Yang blames teachers' unions for the pace of school openings. Unclear if he blames COVID or lack of funding as well. Dianne Feinstein, the latest senator, show openness to filibuster reform. With that and about... Oh, we also have Republican U.S. Representative Tom Reed from here in Western New York has announced he will not run for re-election next year in the wake of sexual harassment accusation against him. He apologized for it, said he's not going to run again. All this and more on today's Majority Report, coming at you right now. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. It is a happy Monday to you. Emma Vigeland is here with me, as always. How are you, Emma?
I am doing well. Happy Monday.
And we should say, I should say, like, officially, happy spring. Spring happened on Saturday, as you know.
It sprung.
There is definitely a feeling in the air, without a doubt.
I know. I mean, it's like the weekend here, it just felt jubilant in a way that things hadn't in a while.
It's a big deal. This is probably the most desperate for spring I feel like I've been in getting up there extended life because of combination of COVID and whatnot.
Yeah, and 1 in 6 U.S. adults fully vaccinated. So lots of things are springing to life right now.
That's right. And there's different reports out there that, you know, maybe there's been a significantly higher amount of infection that we're not aware of. There are places in this country where the numbers are you know, dipping and dropping precipitously. There are other places, New York is among them, that the numbers are not just stubbornly not going down, but starting to edge up. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have across the country various variants of COVID. So we're not out of the woods yet. But we can see, we're not out of the woods, but we can almost see the clearing. So we'll see with that. All right, let's get to this quick because I want to get to our guest as soon as possible. There has been, I mean, we have been reporting for the past couple of weeks on the failure of the Biden administration to deal, and not necessarily their fault totally. I'm talking just from a purely execution standpoint. I think there's some very good arguments that various policy decisions they have yet to make that need to be made, more so on the interior of the country in terms of dealing with undocumented immigrants who are here in the country already. But at the border, there's simply not the apparatus that's needed. Every year at this time, there is an increase in undocumented immigrants who are coming because in anticipation of the good weather makes it easier to travel. And there's more work associated with farming and et cetera, et cetera. And there is a lot of misinformation out there, and the media is doing their darn best to make this into some type of like broad crisis. And
it's having panels at the border,
which is sort of an amazing revelation that they could do that by bringing everybody down there. Because the idea that there aren't there haven't been over the past 4 years real issues down at the border, I don't know. That's pretty stunning. But here is, and we will talk more about that. Certainly by the end of the week, we're going to have some folks who have actually been down to the border and get a real sense of what's going on there. But here is a good example of a member of the media actually sort of calling some of the BS BS. Mehdi Hasan had Dan Crenshaw on his program. Dan Crenshaw, of course, taking a break from his Marvel movie parodies to come on and actually have a conversation. Here's Mehdi Hasan basically calling Crenshaw on all his BS.
So let's talk about what you and the Republican Party call the Biden border crisis, this idea that he created it since coming to office. Let me just put some numbers up on screen. You can see clearly from those CBP numbers that since the pandemic and since Title 42 was brought in to expel asylum seekers at the start of the pandemic, border apprehensions have gone up month after month. The truth is Joe Biden did not inherit falling numbers. He inherited 9 consecutive months of increases at the border. It's right there on screen for single adults and for families and kids.
Yeah, I'm not sure where you're getting your data from. Look, in February, we had over 100,000 crossings. Back in November, there was about 800 people in CBP custody. Now there's about 10,000. Migrants will tell you, as reporters are interviewing them, that the Joe Biden invited them. The drug cartels are passing this information along. Look, there was very specific policies that were reversed as soon as Biden took office. As you mentioned, that I said in our Twitter exchange, remain in Mexico policy, and really importantly, the asylum cooperative agreements with Northern Triangle countries. This basically reinstates a process of catch and release. When people think that they're going to come across the border, as long as they have a child with them and they're going to be released, then that's a huge incentive to come across, especially when they're going to get a bus ticket wherever they want, and now a hotel room, because that's what's being funded. So the incentives are pretty obvious, and we have to ask ourselves the question, is this a sustainable policy? And is this fair to millions and millions of people around the world who have valid asylum claims that now are getting clogged into the system and can't get their claims heard?
A lot of claims made there, which we'll try to unpack in the brief time we have together. I just want to stick to one. You said, I don't know where you're getting the numbers from. Let's just pull up the graph again. That is a graph from the American Immigration Council based on CBP figures. Those are CBP numbers. If we pull up the graph, I just want you to have a look at that graph we just had. That's 9 straight months. You can see there, Title 42.
I can't see the graph, but I can tell you But I can tell you, I just got the
it's
phone.
Nine, well, let me tell you, it's nine
CDP.
Straight months. Hold on, Congressman. Nine straight months of increases in immigrants being apprehended at the border. Joe Biden did not inherit
nine months of full. Just to be clear, you're just denying that this massive increase happened in the last couple of months? We're just denying that?
No, I didn't deny there was a massive increase. I can agree there's a massive increase. Can you agree there were 9 months of increases prior to Biden coming into office? That's what the CBP figures show.
These are not substantial increases. Look, I just got off the phone with one of the former CBP chiefs.
So that's what he keeps trying to rely on, anecdotal data. And later in the conversation, he goes, well, why don't you go down to the border? Why don't you go down to the border? Well, Dan Crenshaw, why don't you acknowledge the data that's put in front of your face that you keep questioning where it's from? Mehdi Hasan answers that question. He has no choice but to deflect because it runs contrary to his narrative.
I mean, to be fair, he very well could not. It's possible he's not seeing the graph because he's just talking into a camera.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to see the graph as well. But the bottom line is, look, as far as the reason why there are so many kids at the border, there is a Rule 42 that was instituted by the Trump administration that basically, on top of some other policies, that basically said we're immediately expelling. In fact, not even admitting for processing anybody who shows up at the border because of COVID. And in this instance, the Biden administration said we will not reject unaccompanied children. We will not allow them to just shove them off and have them go off into the desert or just walk back into Mexico or whatever it is. The problem is they do not have the facilities or the structures in place to deal with these people, with these kids coming in. And that's why apparently they're looking to go to maybe airlift a lot of kids up to the Canadian border where there's facilities. We don't have the same type of situation there.
And Biden has kept Title 42 in place, which basically was it's the United Nations says they think it's illegal under international law because when people are seeking asylum, it almost automatically rejects migrants. Less than 1% were let through under Title 42 in the past, 365 days since this policy basically was in place. So, like, that's also categorically false. He did keep the bones of the Trump administration's policies on this front in place, and that's progressives like myself don't like that. That's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, we have it's a real mess there, and it's just a question of, like, at one point, there's going to have to be this neither fish nor fowl type of policy. It's just not going to work. At one point, they're going to have to make a strong, definitive move and then just fight one, essentially, front in this sort of political war that is being waged on it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a moment with Chase Strangio. Meantime, folks, stressful period of time. Everybody's trying to stay healthy. I know I have. Very important to know what you're putting into your body when you take any type of vitamins or really anything for that matter. I'm trying to eat better. I'm trying to take care of myself a little bit more. And I am trying to augment what I am not getting by not eating properly. And also, frankly, because I'm old. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with a high-quality nutrients in a bioavailable form that your body can actually use. You're not going to find sugars, you're not going to find GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, or artificial colorants in Ritual. Ritual is now available for women, men, and teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. Ritual's delayed release capsule designs deliver a high quality nutrients, including vitamin D3. Very important, particularly when you're a shut in like myself, in just two daily pills. You'll always know what nutrients you're taking and where they come from thanks to Ritual's one of a kind visible supply chain. This is actually really cool. You go on their site and they will basically tell you where they have sourced everything that you're putting into your body.
Wow.
Multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping, which for me is also the big thing because I'm always good at starting with the first bottle and then I run out and I forget to get it. And then I'm like, it's too late. Forget it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it. So you can start, you can snooze, you can cancel your subscription at any time. Super easy. If you don't love Ritual within your first month, they refund it, refund your first order. For me, it's something that I've been able to do now for months to maintain this, I guess it's a ritual, where I'm actually like consistently taking vitamins. I know, like, at the very least, my doctor said I didn't have a D3. That's my consistent
deficiency.
Yep.
Not enough.
Not enough sun.
Sun.
Yep. Can you believe it? I'm really shocked. I'm really shocked by that.
100% can believe it. Yes.
Yeah, I know it's very hard to understand and believe. But folks, get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your ritual today. We will put that URL in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Meanwhile, Hunt a Killer, things are a little bit boring at home. Stuck at home, tired of watching the same old TV shows over and over again. Hunt a Killer is a murder mystery subscription game that delivers an immersive experience right to your door. Hunt a Killer brings people together by challenging them to decode ciphers. You examine clues. You solve puzzles. They send you every month. You can actually speed it up if you want. You sift through documents. They got, you know, it's evidence and audio recordings, case files, eliminating suspects, photographs. You gotta identify murder weapons. Until you crack the case, you catch the killer. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. I've noticed some escape rooms that are actually opening. I am not.
Oh, really?
Never.
No.
Not for a while.
Well, that's because you have Hunt a Killer.
Exactly. You can grab some wine. I don't do that because I do it with my child. But you can hop on Zoom. You can play with socially distanced friends. Plus, you can join Hunt a Killer's spoiler-free community with thousands of members to help each other solve difficult puzzles and talk about true crime. Also, part of the proceeds for every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation, which is a an organization that helps solve real life cold cases. In fact, the one that Mile have been doing is a cold case. I don't know if they're all cold cases. I don't think so. But this one is. Oh, shoot. It's the theater. I can't remember it. Matt, you've done this one, right? It's the 1930s theater. And somebody finds like a, you know, info in their attic, and they're going to sell the theater. And
there was a murder a whole in the 30s, and you got to solve it because you want to save the theater, basically.
Oh, that's cool.
I mean, the other one that we did was in real, was contemporaneous, like modern. But this, I like this one because
I love
it's been
period stuff. Yeah,
it's a little bit of a teaching tool. I'm always trying to figure out how I can get Mila to learn something without actually having to teach her anything. But it's great. It's fun, and it's hard. It will engage you, folks. I promise you. And you know, you set up your bulletin board. You put your red string and your push pin. You don't have to do that, but it's fun to do that.
Well, I have that from all my other conspiracy theorizing.
Right, of course.
I have it in storage.
You already have one.
Right, right.
Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority for your first, for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure you use the code majority and you'll get a 20% discount. Do you have what it takes to hunt a killer? And lastly, Emma's favorite ad that I do.
Saving
2021.
Okay.
New rear, new you. Look, in 2021, you don't make just a commitment to wash your hands every time you go. You go the extra mile, you wash your butt. Somebody had a great sort of, they said the other day, it's like, there's a reason why we wash our hands with water if we get it into something nasty. Mm-hmm. We don't wipe it and just walk away.
Right, right.
The brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It's finally here. It's stylish. It's eco-friendly. It's easy to install and it's affordable. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself. And it does so before and after it's used with the smart spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. These guys have really got it down now. This is the 3.0 model. It attaches to your existing toilet. The other ones did too, which they all require no electricity, no additional plumbing, cuts toilet paper use by 80%. It's super easy, actually, to attach. Sanitation simple. The smudge shield offers easy cleaning. The knobs are naturally antimicrobial. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can upgrade to the new 3.0 model if you're already hooked on Hello Tushy. Believe me, stylish. Or if you're new to the revolution, joins millions of happy customers right now. Have a clean butt every time you flush. I've told this story now a million times. Kyle basically said to me during the early in the stage of the pandemic, he's like, we got a bidet. And I'm like, I'm not going to invest that kind of money. Mm-hmm. But then Hello Tushy. And then I was like, I don't need to.
Yeah.
Much more extremely reasonable, very effective, and super easy to connect to your toilet. So if you've ever been bidet curious, now is your time to check it out, because it's one of those situations where you're like, you know, you say to the bidet, like, where have you been my whole life? It's like one of those type of things. Like, if you just feel
you
like
look at it and say to the bidet, where have you been my whole life? Every day. Right. Mean, talk to your bidet.
I mean,
it's been a long time in quarantine.
It's been a long time for me. Go to hellotushy.com/majority, get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to HelloTushy, TUSHY.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. All right, folks, all those URLs will be included in our podcast descriptions and our YouTube. Now I want to welcome to the program Chase Strangio, ACLU Deputy Director for Transgender Justice. Do we have him?
Connecting now.
Okay, great. Chase, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, I want to start with, I mean, this is, I was just reading from, Dave Weigel had a piece a couple of weeks ago. There have been, and this was, he wrote this 2 weeks ago. So, 79 pieces of legislation in states to restrict transgender rights last year, many focused on student athletes. In 2021, there have been 69 bills written. I've seen different numbers all over the place, but there's a real trend. And of course, and I think already one or two have been passed into laws. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most I've ever seen in the, 6 years I prioritized lobbying against anti-trans bills in state legislatures across the country. I think we're up now to 85 or 86. And what's even more staggering, I think, is we're in, a national pandemic, multiple crises going on, and this somehow is a priority in state legislatures. And these bills are getting hearings. These bills are moving quickly. Some of these bills are so extreme that, for example, in Alabama, they're close to passing a bill that, first of all, was the very first pre-filed bill in Alabama. So definitely a priority that would make it a felony for trans kids to access healthcare, criminalizing not only their providers, but potentially their affirming parents and the young people themselves. So we are seeing just an escalation in numbers, in speed, in prioritization, but also in scope. And then obviously the bills targeting young people in sports as well have picked up so much steam and are seemingly the centerpiece of Republican discourse in state legislatures across the country.
Yeah, the bills on sports, I'm really curious about why that's taken such an emotional hold over Republican legislatures, right? I guess it's because it has this nostalgia factor of, the football team in your town or whatever it may be. Can you expand on those bills specifically as why they've been kind of the anchor for a lot of the legislation that we've seen throughout the country?
Yeah, I mean, it is curious, since every single time one of these bills comes up for a hearing, not a single Republican lawmaker who introduces it can locate an athlete in the state who is transgender. So it's an odd prioritization. But I don't think it's about nostalgia for sports necessarily. I think what it is a shift from the restroom bills that were attacking trans young people in 2016 and 2017. Those largely failed. They were struck down in court. We're not seeing them anymore. And this is just the new manifestation of that same effort to target trans young people, to reinforce reinforce the sex binary, to increase the sort of power of the state to, you know, further establish and surveil people's bodies in such a way that allows more control over all young women and girl athletes. Because even though these are fixated on trans women and girls in the conversation, all of these bills create some sort of sex verification mechanism that would subject all athletes in women and girls sports to some sort of dispute over their sex that could result in them having to turn over a ton of private medical information to the state. Georgia's bill, for example, which thankfully died, would have convened a panel of three physicians to scrutinize the medical records of any young girl athlete who had their sex disputed for any reason. So yes, I do think there's this nostalgia for sports potentially that is, you know, used in the discourse, but really I think what we're seeing is sort of the old moral panic around sort of any deviation from the patriarchal family structure, plus a shift from the bathroom bills to the targeting of trans kids in sports.
I mean, first off, one of the things about a pandemic is that there's a lot less team sports being played.
Right.
I mean, like, aside from the fact that if you're going to have the first bill that you write in this legislative hearing, you and you're thinking about schools, there's probably two dozen things that you should be working on to make schools work. And you don't even have sports. There's no sport. I mean, there's some, I imagine, in some places, but for the most part, there's not even sports going on. But all right. So, but let's, I want to, like, I mean, because from my perspective, this is just the Republicans moving on. They are completely, whenever they are sort of bereft of some type of like set of policy ideas, they just try and attack the most marginalized people they can find in that given moment. And so let's for a moment, because you wrote a piece some time ago that addresses sort of some of the myths surrounding this topic. All right. Because let's just start with this. How many, like, where, because I know that you're probably dealing with some cases, right? I mean, there's some lawsuits that are going on where cis girls, I guess, or women claim that they're in some way, there's some harm associated with this. Like, for a moment, put your lawyer hat on and defend, or, you know, be the plaintiff's attorney for a moment. What is their argument? Like, what is the possible damage that they've suffered?
Yeah. So I think the claims that they're making is that, are that trans girls aren't girls. And so that is the argument doesn't work without that. And that if they have to compete against someone who's trans, that they're harmed. You know, a lot of these a lot of these lawsuits or the arguments that are being raised in state legislatures not only claim a potential injury of losing to a trans person, but having to even be in proximity to a trans person, coming into a meet and having a trans competitor. And that's part of the injury. In Connecticut, we are defending two trans young people who, by the way, have since graduated from high school, who never went on to compete in college because of the massive amounts of discrimination that they face. But nonetheless, three, you know, cis women, young women, filed a lawsuit against the state of Connecticut for allowing our two clients to compete. And not now, of course, in the middle of the pandemic, their senior seasons were all canceled. They maintained their lawsuit, claiming that they were harmed not only by future competitions, but the past wins that our clients had. So any win that our two young transgender clients had in the past, they're in court now trying to take away the past records of any win that they had. Now, mind you, these are two young athletes who worked incredibly hard in high school, trained, 4 hours a day, and won sometimes. They were not the best athletes in the world. When they went on to compete at regionals and nationals, they came in 30th in qualifiers. You know, we're talking about, mediocre high school athletes who had some wins and were talked about like they were, the LeBron James of track and field, and that they would come in and just dominate every single meet, which wasn't true. And what they did experience was harassment at every meet, Fox News segments about them every other month, ongoing harassment in such a brutalizing and demoralizing way that neither of them compete in track anymore. And that, you know, not once did they receive a single offer of recruitment from a college for scholarships. And one of the main arguments animating all of these bills is that somehow transgender women and girls are going to take all of the college scholarships for athletics from cisgender women and girls, which is, I have to tell you, so preposterous, because we live in the world that we live in. There has never been an out transgender high school athlete who has ever received a scholarship to play competitive sports in college. So we are talking about an absolute myth of displacement that has simply never been true and frankly never will be true.
I mean, it's so stunning to me, because there's only very few LeBron James, right? Like, and so
may say there's only one LeBron James.
Well, there's only
James.
One. Okay. But let's just say there's a class of like top, you know, athletes in high school who that you know, because of their presence, are chewing up all the scholarships, right? Like, the numbers would be still so incredibly small. And then if you sort of like filter that with trans athletes who are doing this, I mean, it's almost as if like there's this sort of notion out there that trans women have transitioned because they were men who wanted to have like a women's pro basketball career or something. And so they went through all this as a way of getting a leg up. I mean, it's bizarre. And this is ostensibly what these laws are supposed to protect like girls from, right? I mean, I don't even understand the logic behind this.
Yeah. I mean, it's truly astounding because, yeah, I mean, first of all, nobody is going to transition or pretend to transition to win a high school basketball meet. Look at the world that we're living in for trans people. I mean, the amount of discrimination, the harassment, there is no incentive to be trans. I love being trans, but I'm telling you, like, people are not, you know, this is not something that people are rewarded for. Look at the waves in this. People's healthcare is being criminalized. They're being attacked. They're being pushed out of schools. I almost think we part of what we have to recognize is it's not about sports. And we almost shouldn't credit the arguments because they're so preposterous. And what this is really about is a larger ideological objective to cast transness as harmful, because we have to remember that these bills around sports are moving alongside the bills that would make it a crime to give trans young people the healthcare that they need, that the American Academy of Pediatrics supports. These are not standalone bills. These are not lawmakers who have a history of defending women's sports. Mind you, they're out here talking about saving women's sports. They're not speaking about the disparity in the NCAA that we saw, you know, in March Madness over the past week. They're not speaking about pay disparities in women's professional sports. They're not speaking about a lack of women's coaches. They're not speaking about the epidemics of sexual violence against women athletes by coaches, by physicians, who then under these bills would be empowered to scrutinize the bodies of young women and girl athletes, because it's not about sports. And I almost think that, you know, we lose the fight if we fixate on the sort of way in which the debate has been framed by the people pushing these bills, because they want to claim the mantle of all of a sudden women's rights defenders. I mean, we had Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz in the Senate Judiciary Committee last week, sort of trying to tank the Equality Act, a broad-based bill of civil rights legislation, fixating on the issue of women's sports and casting themselves as the great defenders of women's rights, when, you know, that is absurd. Not only is it absurd just on its face about women's rights, you know, generally, but about women's sports specifically. And so I think that really what we have to do is sort of expose this movement of attacks for what it is, which is a global attack on trans people. You can trace it, at least in the, you know, sort of modern legal context, to, you know, the Phyllis Schlafly's and Anita Bryant's, who have this sort of long history of moral panic about LGBTQ people generally. And this is the latest manifestation of it. And it's not about sports. It's about finding ways to have a conversation that results in the codification of laws that discriminate against LGBTQ people and specifically against trans people.
Is your sense, let's widen the lens here a little bit, because I think so much of when we talk about the involvement in sports echoes what was said 60 years ago, forgive my math, 70 years ago, when we were talking about racial integration in sports. So much of this is reminiscent of what we were saying about gay people 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, and we still hear, but it's sort of dropped because it doesn't have the same political salience that it had, maybe 15 years ago even. So broadening out, I mean, give us a sense of like what trans folks are dealing with across society. I mean, you've touched on it a little bit. These bills come sort of like as the sort of public facing version of stripping trans people of rights to medical help. But we also have a tremendous amount. Certainly last year, we had many assaults and murders of trans people.
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with an epidemic of violence against trans people, particularly against trans women, particularly against Black trans women. And what animates that violence is the idea that trans people are fraudulent and deceptive at our core. And what these bills do is reinforce this conversation that is based on the notion that trans people are fraudulent and should be dissuaded from living, you know, their authentic lives. And so I think that we have to look at these things as being connected. We escalate interpersonal violence the more that we legitimize through proposed legislation, through actual laws, through lawsuits brought, you know, by individuals who are trying to strike down affirming policies. All of those things are inextricable from a conversation that tells the world that trans people are not real, that we are deceiving others by being who we are. And then that's the very thing that we see fueling the violence against people in the streets. That's the very thing that we see causing high rates of unemployment against trans people. The same thing we see causing bullying, harassment against trans students in schools. And that's why we have such high rates of homelessness in the community, such high rates of unemployment and underemployment, and rates of people, you know, forget sports. Trans kids can barely finish high school because of discrimination and harassment. And you add COVID on top of this, we are dealing with a crisis for all students. And then particularly students who are vulnerable in schools, who may not have supportive families. And now we're adding this conversation as if the greatest threat facing the United States right now is, you know, the two dual myths apparently of trans dominance in sports and voter fraud, because that's what we're seeing in state legislatures across the country. Voter suppression laws and anti-trans laws. It's as if those are our greatest problems facing this country at a time when we have such significant, you know, grieving and healing to do, particularly for young people, who many of whom have been out of school for over a year.
I'm sorry. I just did one comment. I just want to highlight that point, because that is it's two sides of the same coin, right? One is we're going to suppress votes. I mean, this is all about strictly about Republican political power. We're going to suppress votes with one hand, and we're going to gin up our own base on the other. I mean, that's basically it right there.
Well, that's what I want to expand upon, or ask you to expand upon, right? Because we saw the bathroom bill and all the I guess, hoopla behind that, and that was happening during the Obama years. And that was clearly a focus on what Sam's talking about, which is drumming up the Republican base. And what a coincidence that now the Republican Party is bringing these bills about high school sports or middle school sports to the fore when another Democrat is in power. I mean, just from observing these and being so intimately involved in cases of LGBTQ discrimination, do you see that pattern as, you know, I know it's not coincidental, but Have you witnessed that, and what's your sense of it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, these are disingenuous policies that have a political set of goals. You know, I think that you can see in, you know, the moments that we see big, huge state legislative and constitutional pushes against LGBTQ people, either after, you know, you have the election of a Democratic president, or you have some increase in visibility and support for LGBTQ people nationally, but a desire either around midterm or the presidential elections to drive out a far right base, or to defend against being primaried from the right when we're looking at state legislators who, you know, are running for office all the time and are always under threat of being primaried from the right. And you can sort of see this in the mid-2000s with constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. There was a proliferation of those around the midterm elections in 2006 at a time with, you know, increased public support for LGBT people generally and for same-sex marriage, you know, specifically. And then these, you know, all of these efforts to drive Republican voters to the polls, 2004, 2006, and then, you know, it failed. It starts to fail in 2008. And again, in 2016, you know, you have the second, you know, second term Obama doing more progressive things leading up to the presidential election. And again, you see, you know, massive amounts of anti-trans bills being filed, both as a backlash to some of the things that the Obama administration is doing in its final year in office. And then, you know, the, you know, an effort to drive out votes, both for the presidential election of 2016, but all of the, you know, state elections. And I think that's where a lot of this conversation has lost too, is, you know, what happens in election years at the, during state legislative elections, when you have representatives and state reps and state senators who are trying to build their base for state level elections. And then if we lose sight of those conversations, we end up in situations where we see the proliferation and movement of these bills in state legislatures that shift incredibly far to the right, where you have super majorities in both chambers, not just of Republicans, but of extremely conservative Republicans who are fixated on certain attacks on certain communities, which is, I think, what we're seeing right now, both as a backlash to the election of President Biden, but also as sort of this growing movement to shift state legislatures to the right, passing voter suppression laws, you know, passing, you know, anti-immigrant laws, passing anti-trans laws. This is a, you know, we saw it in North Carolina over, you know, between 2012 to 2016, and now we're seeing it all over the country.
Chase, give me your sense of what the Biden administration has done. There was a couple of very early on executive orders that reversed some Trump executive orders. Give me your sense of what Biden has done and what he could do strictly as the president, as opposed to, you know, waiting for some type of legislation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a complicated position to be in when it comes to executive power for a number of reasons. I think as we've seen for the last 20 years, there's been sort of an expansion of executive power. And then what that has resulted in, of course, is a whole bunch of lawsuits over everything that the executive does. So I do think there is a constraint on what we are going to see, because already we've seen so many of Biden's early actions being challenged in court, nationwide injunctions sought to put everything on hold. You know, one of the first things that he did do when he came into office on day one was issue an executive order, essentially saying, I'm going to follow the law when it comes to protecting the rights of LGBTQ people. You know, he says the Supreme Court held in Bostock, the decision from June of 2020, that LGBTQ people are protected under federal law. And unlike my predecessor, I intend to enforce federal law as such. That, of course, results in a ton of backlash. And part of what we're seeing in state legislatures is a response to even just the simple affirmation by the Biden administration that they intend to follow the law. I still think that's an incredibly important statement coming out of the federal executive, and that I suspect we're going to see increased action from the Education Department, from the Justice Department, from Health and Human Services, enforcing, you know, civil rights protections for LGBTQ people in healthcare, in education and in employment, and sort of across the spectrum of legal protections under existing federal non-discrimination statutes. So that, you know, I think is a huge step, a huge change from the prior administration, which was essentially, you know, using its civil rights authority to hurt trans people, to hurt LGBTQ people generally. So that we're starting to see. I think the difficult thing is that these state legislatures, they don't really care whether their laws are unconstitutional, whether these bills violate existing federal civil rights protections. They know that they do, and that, you know, part of what they're banking on is the ability to defend them in an increasingly hostile judiciary for LGBTQ rights. And so while we, you know, I will continue to hope and expect and push the Biden administration to have robust protections for trans people across federal law and to enforce existing laws in a way that protects our communities, I think that there's a real limitation of what that will mean with these bills that are being moved through state legislatures, when frankly, these lawmakers don't care if their bills violate the Constitution and federal civil rights statutes and are eager to defend them in court.
I know you have a hard out, and we will make sure that you make it. But let me just, in that Bostock case, that dealt specifically, if I remember correctly, with employment. is it your sense that, and with the caveat of what you just gave, that we have a lot of now Trump-appointed judges and George W. Bush-appointed judges, federal judges out there, but was it your understanding that that extends to also to housing? And give people a sense, because, you know, I've had this conversation with people who claim, like, you know, we're criminalizing the, you know, religious fundamentalist beliefs about, you know, about trans people, about gay people. And I'm like, it's still illegal. You could still get fired for being gay or trans. And so will you just make people aware of the sort of like the status of the how easy it is to fire someone, to deny them housing because they're trans?
Yeah, and I can go a little past, you know, the 10 of if you can. So we'll get this answer out if it works for you. But so the case held that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination in employment, covers LGBTQ people. So now nationally, in terms of what the law says, LGBTQ people can't be discriminated against in any employment setting that is covered by Title VII. And the reasoning of the case is that, you know, any prohibition on sex discrimination inherently covers LGBTQ people. It's always sex discrimination, which means that the places in federal law that prohibit sex discrimination, which include education, credit, housing, and healthcare, those are all places where we as LGBTQ people have protections under federal law as a result of the Bostock decision. Now, that doesn't mean that people are going to follow the law, but as a result of the June 2015 decision, any place that, you know, prohibits sex discrimination, then LGBTQ people are covered, as well as under the Constitution. And the lower courts that have had cases applying the Bostock ruling, which wasn't in the employment context, to other contexts, have essentially held that, yes, you know, there is no difference between Title VII's prohibition and Title IX's prohibition. So these are expansive protections across federal civil rights laws. So that is true. I think where we remain incredibly vulnerable is, A, people don't know that that's the status. B, people don't follow the law. And that, you know, I think there are all sorts of ways, particularly when it comes to anti-trans discrimination, that people are trying to continue to be discriminatory. You know, and then this sort of secondary conversation, which is we're persecuting people of faith, is, you know, A, not true. There are many protections across these civil rights statutes for people of faith. You know, these, you know, generally applicable civil rights statutes apply and have always applied, you know, regardless of faith, and that there are carve outs for religious institutions and other places when they are operating as a, you know, as some sort of faith-based institution. That does not mean that individuals are empowered when they are operating generally, you know, whether they're opening businesses to the public under state law, whether they're, you know, being employed in a secular context, to then be discriminatory. It does not mean that people of faith are being persecuted. It means that the way our legal system works and has always worked is that if you have a law of general applicability that incidentally burdens someone's faith, that isn't enough to overcome the broad interest that we as a society have in rooting out discrimination. And so ultimately, I think that we have a lot of work to do to educate people about their rights and to stop all of these attacks at the state level.
All right, let me ask you one more question, because I'll be really quick, because this is I just saw this video and it just sort of blew my mind. We're going to talk about it after you leave. The idea that trans folks have now catapulted up a ladder of oppression, there is some type of benefit now or special sort of prominence or accord that is given to trans people in the context of the broader LGBTQ communities, let's say. Give me your sense of like that perspective, of that idea.
I mean, I almost don't want to credit the conversation, because the whole LGBTQ community faces discrimination because of norms and assumptions about how men and women should be, right? Like the idea that, you know, there has to be a sex binary and that all men have to be exclusively attracted to women and that everyone assigned male at birth has to grow up and identify as a man. I mean, these are all the same set of assumptions, norms, and rules that hurt the entire community and disproportionately hurt, you know, people of color within the community, when we think about the overlay of all the discrimination that is at the core of our entire legal and political structures in the United States. So, you know, it's I think the impulse to pit sort of trans people against cis LGBT people is, you know, is ultimately just going to serve the existing dominant structures. And it's really depressing to me that we're having this conversation at all. I think if you look at the statistics and you look at the realities of what it means to be trans and the type of discrimination that we are facing as a community, it's just absurd to me that anyone would locate some degree of political power within transness. Whether, you know, and I've seen these conversations play out, and a lot of it is coming from, you know, this sort of self-victimized Substack brigade that is out here, you know, talking about how they're not allowed to criticize trans people enough, which, you know, I think that, you know, you're allowed to do whatever you want. There just may be, you know, ways in which you are held accountable for those decisions. But that the idea that there's some sort of power in transness because some people want to defend our right to exist, I think is untrue. And the fact that we're even having a debate over whether trans people do or should exist should show you how little political power that we actually have and how depressing this all is.
Couldn't agree with you more. Trace Changio, ACLU Deputy Director for Transgender Justice. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a good evening, afternoon.
We replay.
It all blends together.
The show replays.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We're going to play one of those videos. I just find it sort of stunning, and it is... well, we will play that video. We got a couple other clips left in us. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. So, you know, we set up this clip, and I just happened to see the clip this morning. And so it obviously resonated with me because I knew that we were having Chase on this afternoon. And it has been completely, maybe, I was just wondering, maybe I've just been, I'm missing things. That maybe in some way it is like, it's, you know, that trans folk are having like something turned at one point where trans people were enjoying all of these sort of special privileges. I mean, when you like, just even when I'm saying that as a way that I'm being a little bit over the top here.
They're like the Capitol people in the Hunger Games. They have everything. And the rest of us, we've got nothing.
But it's so online. It's brain broken by online, like one-upsmanship. All like
having a hard time.
You're breaking up a little bit, Matt. But just when I'm saying special privileges, like I just think in my mind of all the times I've heard the right complain about certain segments of the population who are marginal, who are subject to you know, physical, verbal hate, who have a diminished set of rights that they can exercise. They have diminished access to a wide range of things. Every time I hear that, it immediately makes me think of that. To hear someone who ostensibly perceives themselves on the right or against the status quo. I mean, on the left or against the status quo. I mean, this, it's a real shame. But let's play this clip. Do we have that clip?
This is
here it is.
At the many.
This is Glenn Greenwald, and who is his guest?
Louise.
Katie Herzog.
Katie Herzog. So Katie Herzog is a feminist who, from my understanding, is openly anti-trans, and Glenn has cited her before, and now they're speaking together on his.
Yeah, and I should say, like, we should temper that. Like, I think the idea here is that there is an ideological and intellectual veneer that is laid over anti-trans position, and as far as I understand it.
And a feminist position, I want to say.
There are, you know, in various ideologies, there are some elements of feminism. I think they're not necessarily in the center of feminism, that perceive trans women as in some way not
diminishing the experience of being a woman, which is some of the arguments. Ridiculous, as if trans people don't have a million more discriminatory elements to face because they are not, you know, didn't experience all of the you know, sexual discrimination, or I don't even know. This is where the term TERF comes from. This was much of the argument that author J.K. Rowling was making, and that's where a lot of this publicly was discussed.
I mean, all right, let's listen to this clip.
Declare yourself non-binary or trans. You kind of catapult up the ladder of oppression in a way that absolutely confers very concrete benefits, and anyone who denies that is being dishonest.
Pause it.
Absolutely.
I just want to be dishonest here for a moment. What? Like, how does...
What concrete benefits? Name them. Besides being able to, like, maybe you think dunk on you online. Because that's not society. That's Twitter. Glenn,
yeah,
does
he know the
difference anymore?
Let's just put aside just like the individual and just sort of like this perspective that somehow if you declare yourself to be non-binary or trans, that you get concrete advantages. Now, I guess the most generous way of looking at this would be that he means within the context of other people who are in some way marginalized by the rest of society. But I just, if that idea is out there, you really need to be clear on what it is, because the idea that, I can't even imagine what that is. I mean, again, it reeks of what I heard 10 to 15 years ago of gay people are looking for special rights that, at different times, black people are looking for special rights that are going to allow them something that other people don't have. And I am at a complete loss to even imagine what those concrete benefits are. I mean,
maybe he'll explain.
Maybe you get,
I doubt it.
I mean, maybe you get, I don't know, maybe, I don't know, like, maybe there are essay contests out there that maybe I, like, you know, you can enter if you've
it's
gone
like
through.
We're in an aesthetic just, critique of liberal online culture, and like discussion about policy.
But wait a second, but that may be motivating that particular speaker, but the story of trans people getting special rights is a fundamentally reactionary right-wing position. Like that talking point, he's putting it in the context of, you know, relative to other oppressed or marginalized people. But in general, right, this is what we've heard from the right time and time again, that whenever you afford individuals the same rights as is afforded everyone else, You can get married. You can get housing. I mean, you can be denied housing and be trans because maybe, I don't know, you have a dog and we don't allow dogs here. Or like to have loud parties and, grandma lives upstairs and she wants a quiet, whatever it is. But the idea that you get special benefits for being trans in this society is just bizarre. And it is bizarre out of the mouths of right wingers. It is bizarre out of the mouths of anti-establishment,
writers,
civil libertarians, whatever And so it is a strange era that we're living in, without a doubt. But there it is.
Do we want him to finish?
Yeah. Okay. Let's let it finish. Maybe we're not seeing the rest.
Absolutely. You know, what's funny is that the population that no longer you can't opt into this oppression is gay men. If you're a cis white gay man, you are now at the top or the bottom. I can't figure out where it is on the hierarchy, but your position.
The bottom. You're at the bottom.
The bottom now. You were at the top. You were at the top of the oppression scale, and now you're at the bottom of the.
If you even register at all, you're probably just like a white dude.
A white dude. You're a white dude. Exactly. So I find that really interesting. You know, you had your moment in the sun, but it was very short. Lesbians, I think we had around 2002 when the first season of The L Word came out. That was our high point. And then it just went downhill.
Yeah, when Ellen came out, that was a good moment.
Second. Pause it 1 second. Certainly, there is still a tremendous amount of homophobia in this country, obviously. But since Ellen DeGeneres came out, we have things like marriage equality. There is certainly no doubt that the rights of gay people have increased over the past 20 years.
But the
salience as a cultural issue is the Republicans are no longer trying, and there's still some, to be fair, there's still some, but the Republicans are no longer trying to capitalize on homophobia for electoral advantage in the way that they have moved on. And we know, and you can look at it in terms of what has happened with anti-Asian violence. We know when this happens, when this gets unleashed into the ether, the idea that, oh my God, high school sports are going to be, they're about to dissolve high school sports. It starts to have real implications for kids in schools and for adults.
They're trying to burn the bridge behind them after there's been progress for gay people because they want to make an aesthetic argument about not being able to be on the higher rung of the oppression ladder in intellectual-ish online arguments with people. And what that allows is for people that are watching them, who already might be transphobic in their own right, to have another excuse and another narrative, another arrow in their quiver, in order to continue to deny trans people rights. I mean, it is so reprehensible as people who have experienced that kind of discrimination to then turn around and sneer at trans people for being higher on the oppression ladder. This is about your guys' online frivolous debates, but the rest of us are talking about people's human rights, all right? I don't really have time for that anymore. It's so insular and narcissistic and upsetting, especially to see that from Glenn. We already know this is where he's gone, but it just gets worse and worse every day.
One of the things that we saw with the so-called intellectual dark web was the sort of intellectual cover for anti-Muslim rhetoric. And this is a similar exercise.
Yep.
It is an intellectual cover for really just bigotry. Ultimately, I mean, I don't know if that he or she are personally bigoted in that way, but their rhetoric, I don't know. I mean, just even the framing that there is an oppression ladder in and of itself, I think is is pretty stunning. But that is it for us today, folks. We'll be back tomorrow with even more. Lied. We're here.
Yep.
We're staying.
We're here.
We're heading into the fun half, ladies and gentlemen, wherein we will have fun. I promise you. But before we do, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You get the free show free of commercials. And then you get extra content every day. And we got so many things planned in the hopper right now. I mean, I say that all the time. But
what's a hopper?
Tennis ball hopper, right?
Is oh, it? Right. Okay, like the little thing the tennis balls underneath that you push down.
Like bingo.
Oh, I think it's the bingo. You know what? I got to be honest with you.
You're making a bingo reference?
I don't know what a hopper is. It was just a term I grew up with. It means like the thing that you got things planned in.
If it's a bingo reference, you'll never hear the end of the old jokes.
In the hopper. Look, back in the day, we didn't have your fancy video games. We played bingo. become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget AM Quickie, folks. The AM Quickie. AMQuickie.com. You get 6-7 minutes of headline news every morning. Check it out. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. They implied this year, they have this like March Madness with their different coffee flavors. They implied that the Majority Report might be in it next year.
Wow.
And I think if people go and buy enough Majority Report, they're going to have to.
Well, it's like how teams get seeded into March Madness. You got to rack up the wins. They've got to rack up the purchases. I'm not even watching March Madness this year.
I didn't even realize it was happening, to be honest with you.
It was the first year into a bracket. I'm like way too. It's just like Knicks and Rangers, and I got too much.
You got to focus. You got too much going on. There's too much happening. Also, folks, don't forget Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery subscription box that's the most exciting date night you can do at home. Hunt a Killer brings people together by challenging them to decode ciphers, examine clues, and solve puzzles. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. Right now. You can go to huntakiller.com/majority and use promo code majority for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure to use the code majority for a 20% discount. Folks, don't forget, check out the Noma Keyes Show. You can check that out at youtube.com/the Noma Keyes Show. Last week, I got the notice too late on Friday. Jamie made an appearance on the Noma Keyes Show. You can check that out, youtube.com/the Noma Keyes Show. Check out last Friday's episode. I heard rave reviews. Also, don't forget, the Antifada still going on. They're Twitch streaming. They're doing all sorts of stuff nearly every day over there. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Recording a new After Reckoning tomorrow, and Thursday, Shama Sawan and Wozni Lambre on Left Reckoning.
All right, great. We're going to get you that file soon, buddy. You're getting a little shaky.
I thought his file, your files was coming like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Fios and Godot coming at once.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. See you in the fun half.
Since you left me.